This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. We are continuing today in our series with the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. In fact, today is our last program in this series, although we hope to do other things that are related in the future. Our subject for today is restorative justice. I'd like to welcome Lori Knight. She's an attorney. She's a former public defender. She's a mediator. Lisa Stuckey is executive director of Children First Co-Parenting Support Services, and she is a founding member of Common Ground Restorative Justice Services. And Andrea Verschweiver is a psychotherapist and mediator. Welcome, everybody, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
So let's talk about both the principles and the philosophy of restorative justice. We've talked about this off and on over the years on this program, but it's a concept that's not so familiar to people who are working with our criminal justice system today. What is it?
Mary Charlotte, restorative justice is a way. There's a book that Howard Zaire wrote early on in 1990 called Changing Lenses, and it's really a different way of looking at both crime, what crime is, and how we can deal with crime. And the first thing that restorative justice counsels or encourages us to explore is the concept that crime is primarily a violation of relationships. That may sound sort of obvious, but it's really not, given the way our criminal justice system deals with crime. As a former public defender, I would go into the courtroom and a criminal case would be entitled State versus, and then the offender's name. So the perception was that it was the state that was violated, and the district attorney was there to represent the state's interests, not necessarily the victim's interests, but the state's interests. The victim now is notified of court proceedings, but oftentimes in the past wasn't even notified of court proceedings and was kept separate from the offender. The assumption was that the victim most wanted, above all, safety and separation from the offender. So those two parties were kept separate, and oftentimes if they weren't separated, the offender could be reincarcerated. Instead, restorative justice goes to the victim first and says, what needs do you have? Talk to us about the violation that you experienced and whether or not you want any sort of contact with the offender. Physical contact or not physical contact. Do you want to communicate your perception of the violation to that person? And how can we facilitate it in a way that meets your needs first?
Now, some people want to do that, some people don't want to do it.
Absolutely. And restorative justice, first and foremost, looks to the victims. But I think all of us encourage the further use of restorative justice. So we want at least the invitation to be made to the victim. The victim, if they say, no, we don't want any contact, that ends it. If they say, we do want some contact or we want to explore this, then restorative justice practitioners will go to the offender and talk to the offender about whether or not they're in a position to really be accountable for their behavior. So you need sort of two yeses. And if there are two yeses, then the process continues.
It's a really interesting philosophical distinction between the victim being the one who's hurt by the criminal's action or the state being the one who's hurt by the criminal action.
Yes, it absolutely is. I would argue that it's much sort of more human when you're looking really at the victim and the victim's needs. The other piece that I will mention is that restorative justice also looks at the community as a stakeholder, that this violation has occurred, the victim has been hurt, but the community has also been hurt, and also the community has responsibility to help as much as possible right the wrongs that have happened. So it encourages the use of the community in terms of restorative justice practitioners and also takes a very creative approach. For instance, I had a case where I was part of a sentencing circle and it was an economic crime. So there was the victim, the person whose purse had been stolen and whose check had been forged. But the bank was also called into the circle because they had been harmed. And they were able to come in. A representative of the bank came in and talked about the harm to the bank.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about restorative justice is that it really brings up the subject of, I mean, yes, relationships, and relationships among people precede the state. There were people having relationships of all kinds, good and bad, before anybody ever came up with any kind of centralized or decentralized state. But also, I mean, in the time that we're living in now, there is a real disconnect so often between what the criminal does, and sometimes those criminals in restorative justice are teenagers, you know, who really haven't learned empathy yet, not really understanding how their actions affect other people. I was watching just last night, I was watching a television program in which somebody's teenage daughter had done something that was really hurtful, and her dad said to her, "Do you not understand that other people are real? Do you think you're the only one who's real?" And you could see her face sort of fall and the coin drop. But this is something that really happens.
And if I can interject, Howard Zaire, as I mentioned, did write this book called Changing Lenses in 1990. But this is a very traditional form of justice. Aboriginal communities, Native communities have been practicing this. So really, this is sort of the first or traditional form of justice. Even though we talk about the retributive system of criminal justice, what we see in courts and on Law and Order as traditional, and this is non-traditional, actually this is very, very traditional. Just like you said, you know, there were people in relationships that preceded the philosophical existence of the state, and folks were sitting in circles and dealing with, sort of struggling with, and then moving through repairing these harms. They have been for a very, very long time.
What are some examples that we know in history of restorative justice?
Restorative conferencing came out of South Australia and New South Wales, and it involved bringing in the community that was affected by the crime along with the victim. And so they would create a circle or a conference with that community. They did this, the Maori of New Zealand did this. Canadian and American Indian traditions brought in peacemaking circles, sentencing circles, healing circles, community building circles. And the U.S. model actually began in the 1920s, where we created reparative boards that were typically composed of small groups of citizens. And some were intensively trained and others were not, but they addressed a crime or a situation within the community. And then out of that came the victim-offender mediation and dialogue processes, and now circle processes that many people use.
Mary Charlotte, can I actually ask a question of Andrea, because I know that she's got some knowledge about this. One of the great historical examples is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa.
Yes, I was actually very lucky. I wasn't an attorney, but I got to participate with the National Lawyers Guild in being a monitor, one of many, who followed the reconciliation processes, both the Truth and Reconciliation processes in South Africa. And it was a formulation created by the then president of South Africa and Desmond Tutu, in looking at what happened in South Africa over many, many years, who was actually harmed, how were they harmed, and what could be done to heal the communities so that South Africa could then move forward. And so they had these hearings, and the requirements of the hearings were that the offenders would come forward and actually tell the truth about what happened, their actual role in particular crimes, and who else was involved.
What was that like? I mean, were these people really, did you have the sense that there was some actual genuine truth-telling going on?
Oh, yes. I mean, there were times when people were not sure if that was the truth, but the point was that we were here not to convict you or to persecute you, but we're here to repair the harm of the community. So the hearings that I heard were very, very powerful because the offender came forward basically to take responsibility for how they had affected or created problems at that time. So one very, very powerful one was in Richards Bay, South Africa, and it is a primarily African-on-African conflict that was spurred by the white government at that time. And so a young man who was 18, who really didn't have a lot of options in his life, was paid a lot of money and given a very nice vehicle in order to plant bombs at bus stops in various locales in his community, essentially. And he did that. So when his hearing came forward, he was very nervous. It took him several hours to be able to talk freely and not just answer questions. But when he did, he stood up and he addressed a woman who was in front in a wheelchair who had lost her legs due to this crime. And he said, "I am very sorry. I did this to you. I didn't know that I was going to do this to you. I didn't want to do it to you personally, but I wanted to be able to eat. I wanted this nice truck. I wanted these things. And I didn't realize how much harm I would create. And I am truly sorry." And there was still debate. This man had been ostracized by the community. So for him, the relationship of not being able to live in the town that he grew up in was a big deal. But there still was some debate about whether or not he'd be allowed to come back in. And the community left for about 8 hours and had, apparently I wasn't there, a very large community discussion. And they came back 8 hours later, and everyone was exhausted. And they addressed the man, and the woman came forward in her wheelchair, and she said, "This was a terrible time, and we want you to come back." And it was very, very powerful.
Wow. And when people go through a process like that, and maybe you can speak to this, Andrea, as a psychotherapist, they actually change.
Yes. Yes. I think when you are the victim of a crime, for one thing, all sense of safety goes out the window. You don't really know why it happened, where it came from, how to prevent it often. And so when you have the opportunity to speak to the person who committed that crime and you know a little bit about what was going on for them at that moment, what were the circumstances, it may not change that understanding of I'm still safe or not safe, but you have more information and you're not trying to create information out of what you don't know, which tends to create more fear. So it's an opportunity for the victim, if it's a one-on-one mediation, and there's a difference between bringing in community and others, but if it's a one-on-one dialogue or mediation, then the victim has the opportunity to speak with the offender, to get information they didn't have about what happened or why it happened, to be able to tell their side of the story and relate the many consequences a crime might have on an individual, and be heard by the offender. And the offender also gets the ability to hear how that action had affected the person. He gets to be heard and talk about the circumstances surrounding the situation, even if it was very criminal.
Yeah.
And hopefully in this process, the offender takes responsibility and sees responsibility in a new way by having this conversation.
And as we all know from being in families and being in relationships, feeling like you're heard, whether it be in a situation of high stress and high conflict, or whether it be at home or whether it be at work, is absolutely essential. And you, I mean, the metaphor of your feelings being bottled up is very apt.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
We're talking about restorative justice, and I think one of the interesting questions and questions that everybody who's working in the system really has to address in a very careful way is, when is it and is it not appropriate?
There's a spectrum of restorative approaches to these violations of relationships. And I would just put in a pitch. I've worked in death penalty cases, which oftentimes people will think, you know, it's counterintuitive that a victim, a surviving family member of a murder case, someone whose loved one has been murdered, could be open to restorative justice. But I think all of us have, in ways, worked in different with different populations, applying restorative justice principles. And as you said earlier, Mary Charlotte, you know, it's a absolute sort of black line, dark line, dividing line. You know, does the victim want a restorative approach? That's absolutely true. But in terms of in what cases can we use a restorative approach, it's really wide open.
In a death penalty case, you can't restore. What can you restore?
You can restore dignity. You can provide information. I've done work as what's called a defense-initiated victim outreach specialist, which is a very long name, but is long and with some intention to be very transparent. So defense teams in death penalty cases will hire me to reach out to the victim family members to see if, number one, they want any contact at all with the defense team. And some do not, and I've had the door slammed in my face before, but some do. And I had one case in Missouri. It was a death penalty case. And as you know, in death penalty cases, oftentimes the cases take a very long time to be resolved.
Are they always murder, pretty much?
Yes, they're all murder cases now. Yes. But in this case, the case had gone on for a long time, and the initial lawyers actually had been replaced by other appellate lawyers. So something was happening on a post-conviction basis, meaning that the case had been reviewed by an appellate court, and the court had decided that the trial had not been handled fairly, and a retrial had been ordered. None of the family members knew that this was so, that there was going to be a retrial. So it was, I went in and approached the family members and said, you know, here's my role. My role is as a neutral person. I'm not here to defend the actions of the offender, but do you have any information, any need for information? And they did, and they wanted actually some information about the offender, which again is counterintuitive. I think restorative justice, if anything, counsels letting go of our assumptions about the criminal justice system and about who offenders are and who victims are. While that's the work that I've done, I've been most heartened, I think, by some of the work that Lisa Stuckey has done working with younger people and working with the communities, because I think really probably great change will come from that.
Yeah, I'd love to speak to that, as well as add a story in a murder case. I wasn't involved with, but it took place up in Taos, where, Mary Charlotte, you asked the question about how can you really do anything to repair harm if when someone's family member is gone. And the family up in Taos asked the offender to visit and take care of that grave on a weekly basis, if I have the story right.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So, and that, you know, keeps it alive for that offender to really understand what they did.
And how does that affect, like, were you able to follow up or understand on how that affected the offender?
No, I wasn't involved directly. It's just a story I'm very aware of. So I don't have that information for you.
It's interesting, though, because, I mean, a lot of restorative justice, and especially in traditional societies, if I understand it correctly, the restoration can really be, you killed my cow, or you stole my cow, I need a cow, you know, you mm-hmm. or ruined my fence, I need, you know, it's to really genuinely actually restore the physical things that were hurt or harmed.
And that's an interesting point, because the work that Common Ground Restorative Justice does, we work with a model called the Community Group Conference. So we actually approach what we call the person of concern, the offender, because we see that person as the community's concerned about them, but we're also concerned about what they've done and where they're going in their life in the community. And what it is, we speak to them first, and we try to get a picture of whether they're actually willing to be accountable, whether they're even appropriate to to be participate in this process. So once we get clear that they're willing to participate, take accountability and responsibility for what they did, and face the person they harmed, which again, we don't use the word victim, we use harm party to kind of move out of that paradigm of offender and victim, these set roles that people start to kind of embody. So then we go to the harm party. And really we go in asking them what are, you know, will they tell us a story of what they've been through? And then we talk about the restorative process and see if they'd be willing to participate. And next we bring in the parents of the person of concern. We bring in support people to the person that's been harmed, or maybe more than one person has been harmed in the case. And then we also bring in community members that have no experience, no direct experience with what has happened. And they're there to kind of represent the community, how this incident has impacted the community, and share their wisdom about how harm can be repaired. And Andrea brought up before some of the key principles of restorative justice is who has been harmed, what is the harm, and how can we repair it? And many of the cases that Common Ground does, because we get youth that are coming through the criminal justice system already, we have a small contract with Children, Youth, and Family Services where the funding fluctuates back and forth, but we've been very lucky to do the work. The teens, when they participate in this process, when the harm party listens to the teen about what the teen has done, you know, who they think they've harmed, how have they harmed the other person, and what they're willing to do to repair the harm, the harm party often sees that this teen is also a harm party, that this teen's family has been discriminated against. They're coming from a situation of poverty and lack of education, and we find many cases where the schools have really not handled it well, and the police have come in, and kids have been arrested, when really we could have worked with that situation restoratively ahead of time before they are in the criminal justice system. So again, that's another piece of restorative justice, is to sometimes be able to have that process take place before people have entered the criminal justice system. And the big piece also in sitting in that circle is every person speaks their truth, their story of what happened, how they've been harmed, how, as I said, the person of concern has harmed the community. And no one at the very beginning of the circle can interrupt anybody. Everyone just gets to speak without anybody questioning it or say, that's not what happened, or that kind of thing. And what happens is when the person of concern listens to that harm party talk about how their entire life has changed, or the computer that you stole has my entire family's pictures, and it's the only place those pictures exist, that teen who may have no empathy and only seen that they're getting a computer because they want a fancy pair of sneakers, or in other cases, we have kids that have stolen because they see their parents struggling so much. So this is where listening to each other, being able to really hear the other person's story, really builds empathy for the teen, for the other person, as well as for the harm party towards the person of concern.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, if, you know, to probably oversimplify, but it's like everybody seeing everybody else in the situation as a human being. And I think, you know, both the person who commits the crime maybe doesn't see their victim really as a fully human person. And at the same time, once the crime is committed, you don't see the criminal as a fully human person. And now part of the restoration is bringing us all back to the fact that we're vulnerable human beings walking around on this earth.
Yeah. Part of the restoration process in the community group conference is that everybody has input into what the youth will do to repair the harm. And you spoke to that, you know, sometimes people want the exact thing they've lost replaced, for example, which we kind of call more of a transactional encounter. And often in this situation, what everybody realizes is, one, sometimes the person of concern actually goes and does physical work or does something direct for the person of concern. Other times, the harm party wants that that teen to go bring their grades up and not drop out of school and, you know, show, you know, do some things for their parents as well. And it doesn't become about the harm party just wanting money or replacement of the items, but there becomes a genuine concern of how can we reintegrate this teen back into the community. And there's so many unbelievable stories of what has been created for those teens.
We're talking to Lori Knight, Lisa Stuckey, and Andrea Verschweiver about restorative justice. And one of the things that I asked each of these wonderful ladies to do before we started was to send me, and I've been reading them over the last week, stories from their own work in restorative justice. And each of you has done a lot of work with people. And there are some really successful stories and some not so successful stories for various reasons. But one of the things that I noticed, and Lisa, you were talking a moment ago before the break about youth, is that I don't know if there was a single story that didn't involve a 13-year-old boy. What's up with that?
Well, I think I will say that we get a lot of young girls as well that are involved. But, you know, I don't know that I can speak, maybe Lori or Andrea can speak to why that is. Maybe young boys feel a little more alienated than girls socially and that kind of thing. But I can speak to an amazing story of a 13-year-old boy who was being pursued in a parking lot by a gang of other boys. And this kid was pretty much a good kid. And they told him, you either steal that woman's purse or we're going to beat the heck out of you. And, you know, he was petrified to try and, you know, he didn't want to steal the purse, but he was also more scared of being beaten up. And so this woman was about 70 years old, and the woman held on to her purse and then till she finally fell down and actually ended up breaking her shoulder, which was traumatic. And when we finally, went to hold this circle, the young boy totally wanted to participate, but the harm party was so devastated and in so much fear that she absolutely didn't want to participate. So what we did was use what we call a surrogate harm party. And we were able to find another elderly woman who had actually had to go through the surgery that this woman was going to have to go through. And basically the outcome of the whole circle was pretty amazing, because what was requested and what the young boy wanted to do, he wanted to do something to make it better. And he's, you know, young, but he got a permit to be a young worker. And he raised the $400. He worked to pay the $400 deductible for the woman. He wrote her an apology letter, and he was also asked to go and be of service at elderly centers. And he was only required to do 10 hours of work, and he loved it so much. And he saw how much he helped. He would go in and read or play cards with them. He did 45 hours at an elderly center.
Oh, my goodness.
And he's just an amazing kid and has done really well. And unfortunately, he never did get to meet the harm party, who might have then been able to have the healing that comes when you actually get to share how hard it has been. And also see that this kid was just in a very bad situation and very scared himself. So yeah, that was just an amazing story. So
there was another story of a young person who did something, and the person that involved driving a car, we didn't have a license, and he drove into somebody and the car was damaged, and the guy who was driving the car actually was a person who was able to offer the kid like an internship or something, or some kind of job, and they ended up being like lifelong friends.
Yes, yes, that was a really fantastic connection. The young boy, or the young man, he was 13 as well, and I can't say why that is, except it might be a developmental issue of 13 is a time to break out and challenge themselves to do things that they wouldn't normally do. This young man stole a car. It was summer, and he was bored, and his neighbor's car was sitting there with the keys in it turned on, and he just couldn't help himself, and he jumped in the car and didn't know how to drive. So as he's trying to drive down the street, he's hitting fences and other cars and doing a lot of damage and getting himself very scared. But not knowing quite how to stop, he ran into an intersection and hit a man in his truck. And he did a lot of damage to that truck. He didn't harm the man terribly physically, but certainly scared him. So we came together in conference, and they discussed what had happened, and the young man had been able to discuss what was going on with him, why he did it. Didn't really have a great reason except that he was bored. But he also came from a family where he was being raised by a single mother, and she was working a lot. So he was left alone and didn't have a lot to do. And so in their discussion, the older gentleman said, you know, would you be interested in being a young intern in my office? And he was an important political figure here in town, and the kid said, sure, that sounds like fun. And it was agreed upon 3 mornings a week he would come for a couple of hours. And the kid, by the end of the summer, enjoyed it so much, and so did the older man, that they continued it for years, that he would actually come after school and during summers, and that man became a real mentor to this kid. And so very successful outcome for both parties.
Yeah, and that speaks to that whole idea of healing the community in a different way, instead of having these people be estranged from each other and the kid cast off into the criminal justice system. They're brought back into the community, and that's a big part of the Native or Indigenous approach, is everybody's needed in the community, so we can't just to keep us together, you know, so we can eat and do the work to stay alive, and so we can't just throw people out.
One of the things that has been said about restorative justice was it takes a lot longer than getting somebody just in and out of court. But I wonder if you added up, so this kid who becomes an intern and leads a happy and successful life, that kid's probably never going to go into the criminal justice system again. So if you add up like the total time that people keep reoffending versus not reoffending, if they've gone through a restorative justice process that actually changed their behavior, I wonder if it really doesn't. Maybe it's a time saver for the system as a whole.
I would say it's definitely a time saver and a money saver.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you get a teen that's going to turn around, first of all, not going to be incarcerated, we're not going to be taking the resources of police and courts and judges and attorneys and public defenders, you're saving a lot of money for the state, especially incarceration. I think the figures go between, like, $90 to $135 a day. And then the idea of a teen recommitting crimes, I mean, that's costly. It's costly, you know, from just a financial standpoint, but it's costly to the community in so many other ways. So
there are some cases that really don't work with a restorative justice approach, and some of those are where the people are actually not ready to face themselves or face their crimes.
Yeah, I think it may be a question of semantics, but I think you can have a restorative approach even if a case is not suitable for a particular application of restorative justice. And by that I mean, you know, I restorative approach would be to go to, as Lisa said, the person who's been harmed, and just talk to them about, you know, ask them to address the harm that, their experience of the harm that was caused to them, and what might be available to remedy that, regardless of whether or not the person of concern or the offender is able or willing to participate in restorative justice, for instance, a victim-offender mediated dialogue or even a community conference. Treating people, again, as Lisa counseled, people who have been harmed not just as sort of a cookie-cutter victim, but as a person with a particular history. And that's been true in death penalty cases. There have been some people who are surviving family members of murder victims who have not been in favor of the death penalty in a case in which the state has chosen to pursue the death penalty. And some of those folks have felt really abandoned by the criminal justice system because what their perception of their needs is does not sort of conform with the state actors' needs. And I think restorative justice, if anything, takes a very curious approach. And even as we're talking about success, I think I would, as maybe as the devil's advocate, or actually not as the devil's advocate, but just I would encourage us to think beyond sort of time and money. Because restorative justice really looks at the qualitative experience of a community's life. What kind of a community do we want to live in? How do we want to treat our community members? Do we want to have an approach that both holds people responsible, but also, as Andrea said, invites them back into the community to try to repair the harm that they've caused? We are all offenders and victims, and that's one thing that I love about restorative justice. It encourages people to look at kind of the bigger story, and that's been one thing that's been really open my eyes as I work, even me, who, you know, think that I know sort of how restorative justice works, to start approaching the people who have been harmed and to listen to their stories. You know, they'll say that they want something that is surprising to me. And I think restorative justice leaves room for the larger stories, those surprises.
What have been some of those surprises?
So the surprises, again, this death penalty case that I had in Missouri, it was surprising to me after I had met and worked with and developed a relationship with one of the family members. He was really curious about what the offender had done. And this was a murder case. This is a case, you know, this was a case where if the person didn't get the death penalty, they would spend the rest of their life in prison. He had a very strong desire to know how the offender had used the time in prison. What programs had he chosen to participate in? Were programs even available? Had he had disciplinary reports? You know, that kind of detail. Oftentimes we think of victims, the last thing they want to even think about is the offender. This person, this family member, had a very strong interest in knowing more about the offender. And we were able to go and meet that need in a way using the defense team's information that the prosecution would not have had. It sounds a little sad and morbid, but oftentimes in death penalty cases, the victim family members want to know what happened in those last few moments before my loved one was murdered, and why was my loved one singled out? And Andrea talked about that in terms of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I think going in, that was surprising to me because it's just so hard to even imagine when I think about, you know, my loved ones, that a family member would have that abiding need to get that information. But that is information that only the offender can provide.
When do we use restorative justice as a substitute for our regular crime and punishment justice system? In other words, like just on a purely legal level, how is that decision made? When is it made?
So the typical legal answer is it depends. And it depends here as well. It depends really on the community. You know, different state by state different states have different approaches, different communities have different approaches. Sometimes restorative justice is used as a diversion program. For instance, we have a great new diversion program here dealing with folks with substance abuse problems that's gotten some press in the paper here in Santa Fe. One of the things that is very important is that restorative justice not be used as a form of currency almost. It completely devalues and degrades restorative justice if the offender goes into or agrees to participate in a restorative justice process thinking that he or she can get something out of it. That's kind of difficult to navigate, and different communities have taken different approaches. Sometimes it's a parallel approach. I had a case, there was a retired district judge, Peggy Nelson, who was a wonderful supporter of restorative justice in Taos. And in that case, I participated not as a facilitator, but as a criminal defense attorney for someone that was referred to a sentencing circle. And in that case, the person had already pled guilty, and the sentencing circle was convened to make recommendations to the judge about what the sentence should look like. So the person wasn't going to, and the judge was the final arbiter about what the sentence would be like. That's just, you know, you never want something that's counterintuitive. Is there have been restorative victim-offender mediated dialogues held in death penalty cases where the offender was sentenced to death and knew he was going to be executed. And restorative justice processes happen nevertheless. And I think that really speaks to the power of this process and the very human desire of all of us to sort of come together in some way, in some circumstances, and try to find, you know, what I would call healing. Although I want to be very clear that, you know, we're in a TV culture or a Netflix culture where we expect, you know, oh, the only successful, you know, the success in a restorative justice process is going to be a victim who finds forgiveness in their heart and opens their house and home to the offender, and an offender who just melts and is absolutely accountable. And, you know, we're dealing with flawed people, imperfect people. We are all imperfect human beings. That doesn't have to happen for, I believe, a restorative justice to be successful. The other piece that I would introduce is that this isn't, you know, we're used to sort of quick, as you said, Mary Charlotte, a quick, you know, the hearing is scheduled at 11:15, so let's get it done and out of here. Restorative processes oftentimes, they have a life of their own. So there may be a convening of a circle, and then there may be a need to convene the circle again. And I've had that experience. I think that is not a failure, but actually a success of restorative justice, to understand that our lives as community members go on and on and on.
How common is restorative justice in the U.S., here in New Mexico, in Santa Fe? I mean, we talk about it, but is it a very sort of like one half of 1% thing, or what are we looking at?
Well, I think that that's a slightly difficult question in that I've seen restorative justice come in and out of communities for various reasons. So New Mexico at various times has had very strong restorative justice programming. And there are organizations and agencies that come forward to be the facilitators of this process. And at different times, it's been very powerful, and at other times, not so much. And part of that is funding, that it is difficult to find funding to support the professionals who are facilitating the cases or to provide the spaces and the outlets to do this. And each case does take a little bit of administration work, so funding is necessary, and it's not always available.
And I would say there are pockets, you know, all over the country, and it's becoming more popular. And I think, like Andrea said, it comes and goes because of funding. But, you know, Oakland, California has a big program. Silver City down in southern New Mexico has a program. Pennsylvania's involved, Massachusetts, Minnesota, obviously, where Howard Zare is from. So there are lots of pockets. They're small faith communities that are, you know, trying to work with it and support it in their communities. So I think it's really education. You know, I found many, many people that as we bring them into the process, whether community member, a harm party, a parent, you know, we keep statistics, and I just want to acknowledge Deborah Oliver and Mary Ellen Gonzalez. Deborah, the team, we all worked together to start this program, and does tremendous administrative work keeping track of our statistics and recidivism. And, you know, you really see how valuable it is to the people that participated in and are blown away by the process, you know. And it is about facilitators having skill, but it really is the concept and the process that makes it happen.
You know, if I can just interject quickly, there's a great program also in Baltimore, Maryland.
Right.
And just one tiny little point of correction. I think Howard Zayer he's been based for most of his career at Eastern Mennonite University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and he's retired now, but he trained Kay Pranis, in Minnesota.
Right, thank you.
I think that this work, one of the things that's interesting about it to me is that it really flies in the face of our American mythology of the good guys and the bad guys.
Absolutely.
Yep. You're hitting it.
Yeah. And the idea of revenge, which is it's such an essential part of our like media mythology and movies and that we've been consuming since we were born.
Yeah.
It's absolutely part of the mythology. And the other piece that I would just, and Mary Charlotte, you talked earlier about sort of how people are kept apart from one another. I think especially now, culturally, when we're so used to being, you know, we may have a relationship on Facebook with each other or social media, but we're much less likely, you know, or we'll text each other rather than talk to each other. And what restorative justice asks us to do is to sit down, as we are doing right here, and look each other in the eye and get to know each other a little bit and invest the time. And I hope that the direction of our culture leading to sort of more separation won't keep us from embracing restorative justice. I hope instead that restorative justice can offer or reintroduce some balance where we're encouraged to sit down with one another and recognize each other's very imperfect humanity.
And I'm going to guess that what we're talking about with restorative justice is sitting down with each other across boundary lines of, you know, race, class, what side of the tracks you live on, that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Lori Knight is an attorney, a former public defender, and a mediator. Lisa Stuckey is executive director of Children First Co-Parenting Support Services, and she's a founding member of Common Ground Restorative Justice Services. Andrea Verschweiber is a psychotherapist and mediator. If people want to kind of follow up and maybe get involved in some way or learn more about this, what do you recommend?
Well, I certainly can provide my phone number and email address to contact. And if people are interested in being community members in the process or support or mentors for persons of concern for Common Ground Restorative Justice, that would be wonderful. My phone number is 505-660-5494. And my email address is silverflute, just like the color and instrument, @comcast.net.
Anybody else have anything to add before we go?
Sure. I just wanted, Lisa mentioned that there are some folks, some wonderful folks down in Silver City, and there's a website that they maintain, Restorative Justice New Mexico, and the website address for that is rjnm.org. And they also have a Facebook page.
Excellent.
And if anyone wants to reach me, I'm at laurie@lauriknightlaw.com.
And we will have all of this on our site, santafe.radiocafe.org. I want to thank you all three for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for doing it, Charlotte.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.